Since 1966, I started visiting overseas countries, especially the Middle East. During the years, I noticed that there's a war against countries. But there's something new happening. The citizens of different countries are getting upset with the government. And what you see in Hong Kong is the modern phenomenon. Fighting with the government. You know, when I visited Hong Kong, the streets didn't look like this. But look at this. People are angry and something shocking is happening. I've never seen such a lot of rallies, protests in all my life, like the 2019 situation. Latin America, says the paper, awash in troubles amid protests, uprisings, and a distracted Washington. Al Jazeera calls this a global phenomenon. Just look at this. Angry people on the streets, my friends. I've been visiting Beirut for many years, starting there at 66, and continued my research on archaeology. But I've never seen something like this. Hundreds of thousands of people protesting. What's happening here? Making recordings at Harran just before Turkey's army pass, next to the place where we did our research, on their way to Syria. What? Tanks upon tanks, planes upon planes, soldiers upon soldiers. What is happening on our planet? We visited Najaf Cemetery, the largest cemetery in the world, and neither of us, nor this mourner, dreamt of what would happen shortly after this. Look at this. Many died during the protests. Many. And thousands were wounded. They shout, stop corruption, stop corruption. You know, these things, as a theologian, helps me to think a little deeper. We are living on a time bomb. We hardly finished our meal in Baghdad when all hell broke loose. Look at this. The place is on fire. What do you think? Will their dream of getting rid of a corruption government come true? This is the outcry of millions of people around the world. They are sick and tired of corruption, poverty. I've got bad news. But evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. Before the good news, we'll have more bad news. Now, does the Bible predict a global cataclysmic disaster? You know, I like the Bible. It's a true source. The prophecies in the Bible help me to believe that this is an inspired book. So let's consult the Bible. What's going to happen? Let's read from the apocalyptic book of Revelation about what is happening right now. You know, the Bible is on time. It's a book for all times, especially in these end times. It says, after these things, I saw four angels, angelos, messengers, four is a symbolic figure, standing at the four corners of the earth. That's the entire globe. Now, what are they doing there? Holding the four winds. This is disaster. This is war. Holding the four winds of the earth. This is happening right now. That the wind should not blow on the earth. Not yet. Why not? On the earth, on the sea, or on any tree. So the Bible predicts a cataclysmic of global dimensions. And I believe it. And as John on the Isle of Patmos looked into the future, God showed him a vision of what was going to happen. Then I saw another angel, another one. And look at his direction, from the east. And this word in biblical grammar is very important. Having the seal of the living God. Now, in archaeology, you learn about the seal. And this is a different subject. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea. So these angels are holding the winds that it should not blow upon the planet yet, saying, do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees till we have sealed the servants of our God on the foreheads. So there's a sealing process. And you can look at this on some of my material on the book of Revelation. When the work of sealing is completed, this work is going on right now, then God will say to the angels, this is so serious, no longer combat Satan in his efforts to destroy. Can you believe this? Let him work out his malignity upon the children of disobedience, for the cup of their iniquity is full. You know, there's a time and a place for everything. And God is going to step into history very soon. When the four angels finally let go and cease holding in check the malicious designs of Satan and the fierce winds of human passion, all the elements of strife will be let loose. Can you imagine this? The whole world will be involved in ruin more terrible than that which came upon Jerusalem of old. My dear friend, a storm is coming, relentless in its fury, and we will have to meet the storm. Now is preparation time. How long will it take God to punish the rebellious, stubborn, wicked? It's time to go home, and he's going to finish the job on this planet. How long will the final cataclysmic last? Paul writes in Romans 9:27, for he, that's God, will finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, because the Lord will make a short work upon the earth. It will come overnight, may last a week or two, and then it's finished. We are going home. Can you recall the words of Jesus in the book of Luke where he says that the stones will cry out? And I want to tell you, the archaeological stones are crying out as they've never cried before. Now, what message concerning the history of ancient Sumer will these stones cry out? Because we're heading for a climax. They've got a message. And in this lecture, we're going to explore what happened here. This is part of the rebuilt Babylon by Saddam Hussein. This is part of the procession way. And I waved at these Iraqis and they waved at me. You know, there are so many people with goodwill. They are not protesting at this stage. They may do it later. Now, during this presentation, we will be going back in history to see if there was a similar uprising way back in the past, just like the present uprising in Iraq. Those streets of Baghdad are just full of protesters. So let's see in the history of Iraq if there were similar situations. How was the corrupt government in those early times replaced? We get replacements here and there, but we're going to focus on ancient Babylonia, the Sumerian part of the place. Before going there, just a few interesting discoveries that were made in Iraq recently. These are ruins from the early Sumerian civilization. You're looking at 4,000 to 5,000 year old ruins here. Now, these stones cry out that there was a creation of our planet. We call it the Enuma Elish. There are 7 clay tablets describing how this planet came into existence. You've got a few to choose from: evolution, the Enuma Elish, and the history of the planets beginning by Moses, one of the most brilliant scholars of all times. Clay tablets at Eridu, and this is Eridu. You know, there's no more marvelous cities, ruins. But the clay tablets of Eridu tell us that there were people before the flood. And you know what? The tablets say they lived longer lives than the post-deluge people. What are the clay tablets telling us about the authenticity of the Bible? The Bible says they lived long lives before the flood, subsequently, after the flood, shorter lives. You know, this is interesting. The stones cry out that there is a reliable source, the Bible. Go and check it. Now, what did Jesus say about the flood? He says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be at the end of time. We call this eschatology. So Jesus says, look at what happened there, and this is how it's going to end. One of the 12 clay tablets telling us what happened during the flood. Now you can read it, it's quite a document. And the hero is not called Noah, but he's got a Sumerian name, Utnapishtim, and he's also got an Akkadian name. And there are 7 points that correspond to the biblical account of the flood. And you're looking here at the Sumerian king lists. There are quite a few that they've discovered, and they are in harmony. And they help us to look at the chronology of the patriarchs, like Abram and Isaac and Jacob. And there's a perfect match. So now we know exactly what happened during the time of Abram. Who were there? Ur-Nammu, and who's his later people that followed up in the kingdom, Shulgi, for instance. And then you can appreciate the life of Abram and how God saved his life. In my studies of the Sumerian history, a great history, I came across a king by the name of Uruk-Akhina. Difficult to remember all these names. You don't have to remember it. The first is easy. Ur. That's a huge ziggurat at Ur, where Abram was born. This man's name was Uruk-Akhina. He's the only ancient Sumerian king that can explain what Paul wrote in the book of Hebrews concerning Melchizedek. His writings help us, Uruk-Akhina, to understand the great redemption story, the events that will transpire when Christ comes to make an end to our tears. But best of all, his writings tell the Iraqis about the only solution to solve the present issue with the government. Let's read what Paul wrote. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days or nor end of life, no person on this planet can claim a genealogy like this. There's nothing. Why did Paul write this? And as we continue this lecture, we will see where he found this kind of writing. Now, you're looking at a very interesting clay tablet. It's the laws of Urukagina. Now, we have to compare the law code of Urukagina, which you see here, with the subsequent law codes. Why? You know, if the law code is not human friendly, you can be sure that there will be demonstrations. If a country's law is rotten, you will have problems. Law codes also reveal the character of the lawgiver. Now, this is the most famous one. He was the first one to be discovered. He's in the Louvre. Now, what is this first great Babylonian king writes in his law code? By the way, this is Hammurabi. It means relax, my lord. Strange name. Now, Lex Talionis is you get it in a law context. You have to punish according to the trespass, to the guilt. If it doesn't match, the Lex Talionis doesn't mean anything. Now, he was the first man who mentioned an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So when Jesus quotes this, he refers back to Hammurabi. His law number 22 says, if a person is caught in stealing, he must be punished by death. By the way, if this law would be enforced in my country, very few will stay alive. But you know, death penalty also applied in his law code to more than 20 different offenses, not very serious. And then your status in life determines your punishment. If you are a celebrity, you pay 1 shekel. If you're an ordinary person, 20 shekels. Almost 300 laws. So I don't give him 2% of his laws. And then we had some more laws. The Esh Nuna law, the Lippet Ishtar law, and then at Ur of the Chaldees, we discovered more laws. Here you have some of the laws. This is Urnamu, and the middle one is Esh Nuna, and then Lippet Ishtar, the one at the end. And you can read it, and there's an interesting shift. The younger the laws, the Lex Talionis is not honest. But the further you move back in time, it becomes almost like the law of Moses. Now, this law was also, Abram read the law code of the king who built this Zicharut at Ur. I'm quoting from an article from the Metropolitan Museum in New York concerning the law code of Urukagina. So we've looked at Hammurabi, we've looked at Esh Nuna, at Lippet Ishtar, and now we're looking at Urnamu, and now we're coming to the climax of the best ancient law code ever written in history. The caption says, and you can read it on the internet, the first liberal reform. So there was a bad kingdom, Lagash, and there was a reform. Eventually, the people who protested got a wonderful government. It says civilization was able to advance because people at that time had already noticed the harmful effects of high taxes. Are you paying high taxes? Excessive bureaucracy. Unjustly powerful elites. We're going back 3,200 years. And we see the same thing happening today. We're going to listen what happened here. Unjustly powerful elites and wars of imperial conquest on their society's peace. The article goes on. A clay tablet dating back to 2300 BC tells of the fascinating liberal reforms of Uruk Aghina. I hope some of my Iraqi friends listen to this lecture, because I did my research in this. So he's writing about a new day, new reforms, new laws. Samuel Cramer writes the following. He says, Uruk Aghina, the leader of the Sumerian city-state of Lagash, led a popular movement that resulted in the reform of the oppressive legal and governmental structure of Sumer. So what happens in Iraq also happened 2,300 years ago, also in Iraq, in a place called Sumer, to the southern part of Iraq. Now, here we have a good ruler taking over from a bad one. And this is what the protesters are crying out. We've got bad rulers. We want good ones. This cry was heard in Lagash 3,200 years ago. The oppressive conditions in the city before the reform are described in a cuneiform on tablets of the period. Here you can see one of them. It says, from the borders of Ningirsu, Nin is the female word, from the borders of Ningirsu to the sea, there was the tax collector. And you could not avoid him like today. But this was a very cruel tax collector. Do you have modern complaints about taxes? Listen on the news channels. They are complaining about high taxes. And, you know, how did they spend taxpayers' money? Look at this, protests. Lebanese. Why do these Lebanese people protest? Oh, high taxes. But that's not all. These stones in Iraq, Sumeria, testify of a corrupt government that was replaced by a good one who looked after the needs of the vulnerable. So in Iraq's history, you can go back to good news, where a bad government was replaced by a good one. During the reign, here you get the dates, Uruk Aghina implemented a sweeping set of laws that guaranteed the rights of property owners, because property was just taken. Reformed the civil administration and instituted moral and social reforms. Do you hear the sweet melody of redemption, emancipation in these statements? We need to hear more about this. Uruk Aghina banned both civil and ecclesiastical authorities from seizing land and goods for payment, eliminated most of the state tax collectors, they were cruel, and ended state involvement in the matters such as divorce proceedings and perfume making. You can read more on the internet about this. I'm just giving you a little bit. What was shocking to me was the fact that not only that state was corrupt, but the church was also corrupt. Isn't that sad? The church that should give us an example of honesty became corrupt. Do we have it in our day? He even returned land and other property his predecessors had seized from the temple. He saw that reforms were enacted to eliminate the abuse of the judicial process to extract money from citizens, and took great pains to ensure the public nature of legal proceedings. The restoration of lost property is also found in the writings of Moses in the book of Leviticus. So if you've lost your land, you can get it back at the end of a 7-year cycle. You know, when I studied this man's beautiful character, I thought of the possibility that Shem, one of the three sons of Noah, he was alive at this stage. If he didn't have an influence upon Urukagina and helped him to write divine laws. You're looking at an interesting Sumerian word, amarchi. Some writes it as amarchi. But never mind the spelling. I prefer this one. For the very first time, this word was introduced with the new law of Urukagina into the Sumerian civilization. Armachi means freedom. What? Introducing a law that gives you freedom. This was a brilliant man. If you obey law, you will never be jailed. If you obey law, you'll be free. Tell me, why was I so excited when I read this? An ancient lawgiver saw freedom in obedience to the law. Sad to say, the pulpits do not speak very fluently about the law. The law is abolished, they say. Please, preacher, go back to Urukagina and read what he says about the freedom of obedience. Look at this. This is not the mummy's hand. This is a person. And the word there is amarchi, freedom. Now, does the Bible support this concept of law and freedom? By the way, you cannot separate freedom from obedience. The people were liberated from bad laws to the freedom of good ones. And there you've got the way, again, how they spelled amarchi, freedom. Now listen what James says. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty, freedom, amarchi. I think James read the history of Urukagina with his amarchi. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty, amarchi, and continues in it, you have to continue in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, you have to remember the laws of God, but the doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. The James looked at the writings of Urukagina on the subject. Real freedom, my friend, comes when we ask God, the great lawgiver, to write his law, his character, upon our hearts. And we'll enjoy amarchi, freedom. There is such a freedom in obedience. I'm convinced that Abram knew the word amarchi, freedom, in the context of God's law. Moses writes in Genesis 14, and the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Kedorli Omar and the kings who were with him. Kedorli Omar is not a fictitious character. They've identified him. He was a literal king from Mesopotamia. Kidron Valley. So from where did Abram came? He liberated Lot and his family, plus all the captives from Sodom and Gomorrah, and brought them to the Kidron Valley. Who met Abram here? Let's read it. Then Melchizedek, interesting name, king of Salem. By the way, the Ebla tablets speak of Salem when they refer to Jerusalem. I like, the Bible is so reliable. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And he gave him a tithe of all. Typology. Here we have a literal, ethnic, geographic narrative man by the name of Melchizedek. Now Jesus says the Old Testament refers to who? To Jesus. So if there was a literal king priest, there should be an antitypical king priest. Typology. Who do you think is the antitypical priest king? There's just one, Jesus. Listen what David says about him. The Lord said to my Lord. Now whenever you see Lord in capitals, it refers to Yahweh. When you see it in lowercase, it refers to Adonai. Both titles of the Godhead. The Lord said to my Lord, "Sit at my right hand, till I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion, rule in the midst of your enemies." So who's speaking to who? God the Father speaks to God the Son. Now, where does Melchizedek fit into this picture? The Bible explains it so beautifully. Verse 4 says, "The Lord has sworn and will not relent. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek." So God the Father said to God the Son, like the literal Melchizedek in the time of Abram was a king and a priest. So, Jesus, you will be a king priest. And what a wonderful experience to serve a king priest. Jesus, the friend of sinners. The psalm takes its place among the most majestic songs of Hebrew literature. It has been styled the pearl of messianic psalms. Christ is presented not only as king and ruler of this world, but also by God's solemn oath as eternal priest. We have an eternal priest. He's not going to die. He's there forever. Now, where does Urakachina fit into the word amarchi, freedom, in this picture? Under inspiration, Paul explains to us the beautiful typology of the historical Melchizedek and Jesus, the eternal king priest. And I'm reading a few verses from the book of Hebrews. You can read this chapter on your own time. Beautiful. "For this Melchizedek," he's referring to the literal one, the type, "king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abram," literal, "returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him." He rescued the people from Dan in the north of Israel. "To whom also Abram gave a tenth part of all," first being translated "king of righteousness." I love this. Jesus is a king of righteousness. And then also king of Salem, meaning king of peace. The type was righteous and a piece of and a king of peace. And this is what Christ is. When you study Melchizedek, the literal one, you appreciate the great antitypical Melchizedek, Jesus Christ. And then Paul comes with this. I like this. referring to Melchizedek, he said, without father, without mother, without genealogy, with having neither beginning or of days, nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. For how long would Jesus, the antitypical Melchizedek, officiate as a priest for you and me? Continually, without stopping. He's always there for you and me. When we've fallen, we go to the mediator and say, I'm sorry. He's a compassionate, very compassionate priest, intercessor. I've discovered the meaning of the absence of genealogy. There's no genealogy when we come to Melchizedek. So I went into archaeology and the writings, the ancient writings, and I made a marvelous discovery. Urukagina, the usurper. Usurper means he is a conqueror. Urukagina, the usurper, writes the following about himself. So what could this be? He says, and for the first time, they saw this outside the Bible. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. Urukagina, what do you mean by this? Urukagina says he did not inherit the kingship of Lagash. He conquered it. This is interesting. He is saying, you will not find my genealogy in the Sumerian annals of Lagash. I'm from a different position. I'm a newcomer. I haven't got the genealogy in Sumer. Without father, without mother, without the genealogy. He does not possess the same genealogy as the former kings of Lagash. He's from elsewhere, and he conquered a wicked kingdom and introduced a better one. He brought freedom, amarchy, to the oppressed subjects, which they did not have before. He lifted up the downtrodden, and he gave them amarchy, freedom. Paul uses this Sumerian expression to take us to another good usurper. Who's he? Jesus Christ, the deliverer. Who was he? Jesus, the divine, heavenly usurper, is on his way to introduce a kingdom where abuse will not be found. He is bringing a heavenly amarchy, freedom that did not exist before. Millions of people, oppressed people, are looking for this amarchy, this freedom. What will be absent in God's kingdom? Can you think of a few things? There will be no taxes, no painkillers, no pain, no death, no poverty. In his kingdom, there will be none of these ugly things. What will be present? You can think of all the beautiful things. They will be present in the new kingdom that our great usurper will give us when he puts up his kingdom here. 538 BCE. Cyrus, a great conqueror, came into this festival. And on this wall were written the name Meni Meni Tikal Upharsin. It means your days are numbered. You are found, that was Belshazzar. You found what? Wanting. And Daniel says to this king, Cyrus is coming. And the people of Babylon, which were oppressed, heard the words, Cyrus is coming. Two great usurpers liberated the oppressed people in Iraq of former days. In years gone by, Urukagina and Cyrus. Good news for these Iraqis. In the festival where Belshazzar was killed by the usurper Darius the Mede, as well as Cyrus. God, the great deliverer, my friend, is coming for us, the oppressed. And even if you are wealthy, we have the oppression of pain. We're not safe. There will be another banquet, not like the one you're looking at here. The main item on the menu, can you guess what that would be? The fruit of life. We'll be eating that fruit and we'll never die. I met the dean of the University of Iraq here at Ur of the Chaldees. Now, I'm giving him this message. I hope he listens to this lecture. Professor, dean of the university, when the heavenly Urukagina comes, there will be a new curriculum. We will not study criminology or psychology. Our study, professor, throughout eternity will be the love of God and the signs of redemption. Iraqis walking among the ruins of the once mighty Babylonian Empire. It's gone, sand and ruins. But I've got good news for these friends of mine. I've met them, I've talked to them. When God, the great usurper, comes, they will not have to pay taxes anymore in Iraq. All they will have to pay in the eternal kingdom is gratitude for the new ruler in a corrupt-free kingdom. I met the security man here at Nippur. He's got to look after the clay tablets. Man, they steal stuff and they sell it. So for him, I'm saying, thieves stole some of the most precious clay tablets at your site, my friend. But I've got good news for you. In heaven, no one will ever going to steal our amarchi, our freedom, our happiness. We will have those precious treasures forever. Can you think yourself into such a situation? Too good to be true. The ruins of the Tower of Babel, when they came here, they had a daydream of the most marvelous tower ever built by people. Today, it's just a lot of ruins. In my hand, I'm holding some of the ruins. Daydreaming will only come true when God takes us to heaven. I once read a beautiful poem in Sumerian, Kishkiri, Gub, Mach, Sekil. A paradise is waiting, if I can translate it. It's a magnificent paradise. It's been built by the God. And in that paradise, all you'll find, Sekil is the word. Happiness, security, joy, peace. To this mourner, I have good news in the Najaf cemetery. When God the usurper comes, he will not allow death in his new kingdom. this mourner will never mourn again. Thousands of pictures of Iraqis who died in the war with ISIS. If we have to collect all the tears that were shed over the past 2,000 years in this cemetery at Najaf, there will be another Euphrates. But in the kingdom that will come, no more tears, no more rivers of tears in heaven, only the river of life flowing from the throne of God. And we're going to drink that water and never thirst again. To you and to the mourners of Iraq, I bring very good news. It was written by an old man, deep into his 80s, on an island called Patmos. He writes, he says, I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, a new government, and he will dwell with them. Nobody will assassinate him, he'll be here forever, and they shall be his people. We will identify with the King of Kings. God himself will be with them and be their God. You can enjoy daydreams of a better place, my friend. And then it says, I know you've got pain. There's no human being without pain. And next to each one of us, there's a cup of tears. God counted all the tears you've shed throughout your life. And God will wipe away every tear. Now, if you want to wipe tears from somebody's face, you have to put your arm around that person and do the wiping. God is going to take you in his arms and remove all the pain, and you'll never have pain again. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death. Death of friendships, death of loved ones. No sorrow, no crying. There will be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. When by his grace I will look on his face, and that will be glory for me. Father in heaven, I pray for the millions of people in different countries of the world, poverty stricken, people without hope, people whose dreams have been shattered, people who live with corrupt governments. I pray for them, and may you, the great usurper, come to this planet to make an end to the system of sin and introduce an amarchy, a time of freedom that will last forever. Amen.